Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz interview series. On this segment, we interview talented New York City-based trumpeter Brian Pareschi. On the heels of a very impressive and tasty new album called BP Express, this Rochester, New York native likely has made his way into your eardrums without you knowing it via TV, commercial, movie, and Broadway work. Brian is an extremely talented New York jazz journeyman that has brought his blend of jazz to fans all over the world. He has some of the best stories that we have ever heard, and he has quite a jazz biography. Please dig it.
First of all, Brian, congratulations. BP Express is a great listen, to put it mildly.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much. And
I want to start out by first thanking you for spending a little time with Neon Jazz and to kind of get an idea of what is going on with you these days.
Oh, okay. Well, there's a lot of different things. I'm obviously with the record coming out, I'm in the process of promoting it and getting performances, CD release performances. We're in the process of trying to book some festivals, different gigs around the metropolitan New York area. And then once we can get a foothold there, we move into other areas. The booking gigs in New York especially, there's so many people that oftentimes you backlog a couple of months. So, yeah, that's what I'm doing as far as the band. We have a couple of gigs coming up and a couple of really promising things on the horizon here as far as festivals.
Right on.
Late spring and the summer. But otherwise, I've been working on the Broadway show Motown.
Oh, okay.
So I'm one of these... In New York, it's kind of a unique town in the sense that a Broadway show is like a steady working town.
Yeah.
And a lot of the world, some of the best jazz musicians in the world are in some of these pits, either part-time or full-time.
Wow.
And, it affords you the opportunity to do other things, and it gives you flexibility to take off and do any of the other stuff you want. You can go out on tour, whatever you got to do. So that's been my mainstay for the last, I would say, almost 2 years. A lot of commercial and television work and all sorts of things. Tony Awards, Kennedy Center, all different award shows, commercials, jingles. These are things that I would say they're kind of unique to New York and L.A. If you live in that area, if you're in the right circle of musicians, you can overlap your creative stuff with other stuff that a lot of people aren't even aware that they know of it, but they don't even realize it exists.
I always hear wonderful things about Broadway, about especially from actors, how pure it is and how wonderful it is, and I had no idea there was such a deep jazz element that was a part of that. So
that's very cool. Just to put it in perspective, Bob Minster used to do a Broadway show.
Wow, that's cool.
It's great. Tim Reese. Ted Nash, who's in the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra, Scott Wimpel, great jazz trumpet player. I can go on and on. There's tons and tons. And they go in and out depending on how busy their outside schedule is with their bands, when they're on tour and stuff. But when they're in town, if they have a foothold in that area, they keep it, they maintain it.
So We started out with what's going on today. I'm going to go back to the beginnings of your life in Rochester, New York. What was it about Rochester? Was there a particular jazz scent in the air that kind of gave you that feeling of wanting to pursue jazz?
It's interesting. Rochester is one of those towns, and I would venture there's a bunch of these around the country where you've got a big... creative element because it's got, the Eastman School of Music. What happens in those situations is that a lot of the players that go through those big conservatories, if they don't end up moving to New York or L.A. or Vegas or, wherever it is, Chicago, whatever the places where there's a larger amount of work, then they end up staying in the area and they end up totally bolstering the level of the musicianship and the quality of music in that particular town. So you can, and it's probably true in a bunch of towns, a bunch of cities around the country. You can walk into a jazz club and these are So anyway, I had that opportunity when I was a young kid. My my brother, who was 5 years older than I am, he was a saxophone player. He ended up taking an interest in jazz through my father, who was just a lover of all kinds of music. And my family in general was into all kinds of music and playing records nonstop in the house. So Rochester ended up being the perfect outlet. We would go to concerts at the Easton School of Music. I would go see, you know, different performances. I remember Jeff Tysick, he was a trumpet player in Rochester who led a big band. We would go see him. And, you know, there's a lot of notable musicians that are out on the scene now and well-established that came through that area. Of course, there's, you know, Chuck Mangione. When I was young, Chuck was a superstar.
Yeah.
Dad's equivalent of a superstar. And I worked with his brother, Gap. He had a big band and had different types of things going on in Rochester. And there's just all sorts of great musicians. There's so many musicians that end up staying in these medium-sized cities and just playing. They play on the side. They have their lives, they have this thing, and there's so many of them. There's a trumpet player in Rochester that probably not a lot of people know, but the people that know of him know that he's absolutely incredible. His name's Mike DiMartino, and I remember sitting and listening to records with him, and he just hangs out in the Rochester area and plays fantastic.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so there's a lot of, it's a very fertile ground because of the influx of all the musicians that go through that school and just the nature of the city itself here.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, Kansas City has that flavor. We just lost a drummer. His name was Tommy Ruskin, and he was here for decades. And
okay.
I was talking to musicians about him, and they said, yeah, he had every opportunity to go play with Stan Getz, to move on to bigger and better things, and he just wanted to stay. So that's kind of fresh in my brain. You know, some of these musicians just want to stay where they're at, you know?
That's right. That's right. The move to a big city isn't for everyone. You know, there's so many considerations. If they're married, what's their spouse doing? If they have kids, you know, there's some people don't want to live in a big city. Some people love where they grew up, or they love the lifestyle, quality of life. It's, you know, New York's, I've heard New York, like it's, someone told me the one time that New York's got the best of everything and it's got the worst of everything.
It's like the beginning.
Love-hate relationship you can have with a city.
Well, it's like the beginning of a Dickens novel. It's the best and worst of times all the time, you know?
Yeah, right.
So, why did you pick the trumpet?
Okay, this is kind of a funny story, actually. I was, I went through the normal public school, or at least it was normal when I was going through it, of just in, it was third grade, maybe it was fourth grade. We started in fourth grade, yeah. And you list, when you're in your music class, you list the instruments 1, 2, and 3 that you wanted to play. And I put trumpet first, I put trombone second, and I put drums third.
Hmm.
And then they, I think, as far as I can remember, the band director tells you what you're going to be, what you're going to play, and they try to give you your first choice.
Yeah.
But if not, so they need the trombone players because nobody wants to play trombone.
No.
Sorry. No, I'm kidding. I just offended every trombone player. They gave me trombone, and I believe I got really upset. My mother came into school and told them that I really wanted to play trumpet, and the band director made me a trumpet player along with the other 16 or 17 trumpet players. And they had like 2 trombones and 17 trumpets.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was kind of how that happened. But I actually, to be completely honest, the other influence was my brother. He played saxophone, and he had a really good friend who was a wonderful, wonderful trumpet player. And he actually lives in the D.C. area and works in and around all the military bands. And he does everything, so it's hard for me to put a finger on specifically. But his name is Christopher Rousset. Fantastic. And he's down in D.C. Working as a professional trumpet player as well. So he was very inspiring to me, too, when I was in fifth grade, fourth grade.
Very cool. That's a great story. You know, the one thing I noticed about your bio is that you're all over the place. You're in film, TV, commercial. You just said Broadway. There's probably a good chance that a lot of people out there have heard your work and don't know who you are.
That's probably correct. Yep.
How does that feel? Yep. What do you think about that?
Well, here's the thing. It's you know, I had a conversation with a good friend of mine. She's sort of a self-starter and entrepreneur who lives out in on the West Coast, and she kind of, along with other people, she's not the only person, but I remember specifically talking to her one time. She said, "All right, Brian, can we establish that you've already established yourself as a trumpet player in New York City, commercial and whatever else, that you've done that?" Because I spent a lot of my time when I got here trying to basically create for myself the most opportunities to work. So the name of the game is you have to be versatile. The more hats you can wear, the more feathers you can put in your cap, the more situations you can be put in and be comfortable and have people be comfortable with you, the better off you're going to be. Now, that's not the way everyone does it. Some people, you know, there's different ways to skin a cat. Some people want to they just want to do one thing to the exclusion of everything else.
Yeah.
The problem with that is if you're not like the top person or the top two or three, then you're not going to do anything.
Yeah.
You're going to do very little. You know, if you just want to sing jazz, let's say, you want to be a jazz singer, well, you better be very good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're up against Diana Krall. You're up against, you know, Diane Reeves. I mean, you're up against, these are huge names.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what you're trying to be, and to make it at an international or national level, that's who you're up against. So what I did was when I moved to New York in 96, I needed to work and got to pay the bills and got to pay the rent. And the rent in New York is, it's pretty prohibitive. If you're not paying it, you're out of New York.
Yeah, without a doubt.
So I basically, I got myself involved in any and everything I could do, and I basically learned how to, I worked to the best I could on all the things that I wasn't as strong at, and I developed myself to the best I could as a, you know, to be able to cover any base, anything. Like, I can do it, I'll do anything. So, I mean, to kind of answer your question in a roundabout way, how does it make me feel? So what happens is you end up, you can be the hired gun, you know, that's what I always call it. You can be one of the top calls, and you're a hired gun to work on everyone else's projects. Well, when I would sit there at times and think to myself, well, I'm getting called to play in all these people's bands and tour with all these people. When you stop to think about it, I had all these creative things in my mind, and I had written all this music, but I wouldn't put it out there. I was too afraid to put it out. And I just, you know, it's a different point for everyone in their life and their career. I just said, turn the corner, and I just said, you know, you gotta just put it out. Everyone's been telling me, you just gotta put yourself out there, you just gotta put it out. So you finally, you know, like I said, you arrive at different places. I decided to put it out, because when you're side band, what you're basically doing is you're providing what you have to offer as an artist for someone else to develop their career.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, without a doubt.
So when you work with you know, Diane Schur or Barbara Streisand or whoever it is, you know, or Tony Bennett, if you're working with them, you're helping their career.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're helping to keep, and if they're already established, you're just helping to maintain their status and platform in the business so that they can keep doing all these. So I just decided it was time for me to do that, and that's kind of where I'm at now, because I just have all these things I want to do.
Well, that's awesome, and that kind of goes into my next question here. You've played with a lot of heavy hitters, and, you know, Toots Thielemans, I mean, Phil Woods, Frank West,
uh-huh.
All these names here. What is it like to climb onto stage and be next to that kind of energy and those kinds of people that are doing what they're doing all the time?
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. One of the best experiences you can have as a musician, and it's unfortunately, there's less and less of those opportunities, is to be around some of your heroes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I've been fortunate, and I would say that I've been fortunate for a person of my age to have worked with many of these guys. But if I had been born 20 years earlier, the opportunities to work with all these greats would have been even more so.
Yeah.
It's just, when you think about it, we're arriving at a time now where all the great innovators on the instruments, they're almost all of them are dead now.
Yeah.
All the greats. And whom we just wished happy birthday to a few days ago over the phone. He's still around and doing pretty well.
Right on.
But I mean, there's only a few of these guys left, and even some of the ones that I listed in their bio, a lot of them have passed away.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jerome Richardson. I toured with Jerome Richardson. Here's a good example of the kind of interaction you can have with somebody like that. We were on tour with the Harlem Nutcracker, which was a jazz adaptation of the Nutcracker Ballet. And, I mean, some people may or may not know about it, but basically David Berger, who's a big authority on Ellington's music and extremely knowledgeable on all different types of jazz and everything.
Yeah.
He worked with the Donald Byrd Dance Foundation to create and finish what Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn had started when they did their adaptation of the Nutcracker Ballet. I think it was 1959. It's an album called Three Suites, mm-hmm. where they adapt some of the Nutcracker themes. Anyway, we did a show that went on and adapted all the rest of the music from the Nutcracker Ballet and the jazz ballet. Well, Jerome Richardson was in that group.
Yeah.
And Jerry Dodgen and Joe Temperley, who's Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra fame. And we had, who else? Britt Woodman, who was with Duke Ellington's orchestra for like 10 years. Famous trombone player. We had all sorts of people. We had Roland Hanna playing piano.
Yeah.
And I was sitting next to Tom Harrell.
Wow.
And the great lead trumpet player, Bob Milliken. You're sitting next to all these people, and you're a young kid. So we were in Detroit, and we were in the hotel, and the band was hanging out, having a few drinks around the piano in the lobby. And Jerome, everyone were all hanging out, and we're trying to figure out how Lush Life goes. And
yeah.
That's kind of a tricky tune, you know, and it's got all sorts of twists and turns and the chord changes, and a lot of people, they mess it up. They don't quite get it right, or they substitute things and it's not quite right. So we all were trying to figure it out. No one quite got it. And I went that night, I went home and I shed it. I looked it up, I sat, I looked at it, I figured it out, I went back down in the middle of the night to the piano, and I worked it out because I was just one of those things where I wanted to figure it out.
Yeah.
The next day we're in the pit. I arrived for the show. It's an 8 o'clock show. I get there early, like 7. And the only person in the pit was Jerome Richardson warming up. And he was kind of a salty guy. He liked to give people a hard time. Very standoffish. He would joke with you and then look at you with a straight face, say real sassy kind of snide comments. He's funny, but you didn't always get a good read on him.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there and I'm playing Lush Life, and he just gets up. And I, at this point, I was just some young punk in the band. You know, and he comes over to me. He doesn't say a word to me. And I played it. And he remembered that we had known and figured it out last night. And he just grabbed the soprano and he stood behind me and played Lush Life.
Wow.
And didn't say a word to me. And he and I played, and I played piano. And I remember I was almost, it was just one of the greatest musical moments of my life.
Wow. That's
afterwards, he just tapped me on the shoulder. Just nodded his head and said, yeah, that's it.
Man.
That's like a jazz rite of passage with a guy like that, does something like that.
Oh, man. That's one of the best stories I've ever heard. That's awesome. That's a great jazz story.
Well, I'm not saying those happen all the time, but you have opportunities to interact with these people. You know?
Yeah, sure.
Derek, I took a few lessons with him and did a recording with him one time, and I had him in the recording session teaching me how to doodle talk.
Wow.
How to use my breath, how to use my air. To get inflections and to make the notes sound more like a singer, more vocal.
Yeah.
How you do that. I mean, these are all things you can't pull these out of books.
No.
And you can get them off recordings if you have a really discerning ear, but there's certain things. You sit next to it and you hear it, you know?
Yep. You just got it.
So those are kind of examples. And I could go on and on. It's been tons of, you know, when I work with Quincy Jones, same thing. We were out in Paris. We were doing a tribute to they were honoring the contributions of African American jazz musicians to jazz in Europe. This was 2000.
Yeah.
And I was over there with Quincy Jones and a select group of musicians from New York to be put into a band that was set up in Paris me Cootie. I don't even know if he knows my real name. Cootie. And then it would be, you know, later on in the thing, and he'd want a little background behind the singer, you know, for something, and which was the classic, put the harmony in and kind of a little noodle behind the singer. And he said, yeah, hey, Cootie, give me some of that Joe Newman stuff behind the vocals. Like, you're not even calling me by my name. Call me Cootie and tell me to play like Joe Newman. It was great.
Yeah, that's great.
These are the kinds of things that's kind of a long answer, but that kind of gives you an example what those experiences can do for you.
No, that's great. That's great stuff. And I noticed in your list you had Bobby Watson and Marilyn May, KC, strongholds and legends around here. Have you played here in KC? Do you have a connection here?
Oh, with Marilyn May?
Yeah, with Marilyn May and Bobby Watson. Have you ever played here in Kansas City with them?
Bobby Watson I worked with in New York, and Marilyn May as well. Yeah. I've never played in Kansas City with them. No.
Interesting.
But, in fact, I didn't even know Bobby Watson was from Kansas.
Yeah, he just actually got a star on the walk here. Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he spent a lot of time with Art and started out in New York, but he really grew up here in the area and then kind of levitated back. So I think his jazz punch card has a lot more holes for New York as far as the world knows, but as far as
right.
I think miles logged, realistically, KC's more up there. I'm just going to bring up BP Express. I want to talk to you a little bit about the creative process. And, you know, you've done a lot of side projects. This is one on your own. Just kind of talk to me a little bit about this.
Okay, so the BP Express, when I moved to New York in 96, I actually started this band. I went to Manhattan School of Music from 96 to 98. I mastered some jazz composition and arranging, orchestration, all that. And I wanted to keep, I've been writing for octet, I wanted to keep it going, and I created this ensemble, and for a while it really didn't work much, and it's honestly for some period of time, it was just a platform for me to write, and to kind of hone certain skills in writing. Writing for a group this size is kind of tricky, so like, you have big bands, and then, which there's standard, you know, I'll say standard, but there's obviously quite a few variations to this. There's five saxophones and three or four trombones and three or four trumpets. So you have what can be three different sections, and if you use the brass together, you have two different sections. So you have the ability to have counterpoint and different ideas playing against each other. That's easily done in a bigger group, as long as you know how to orchestrate, basic orchestration skills, you can do that. A small group, like one or two horns, it's tricky.
Yeah.
You know, you can write them in unison, you can write them in octaves from each other, you can write them just a couple of notes apart in intervals, depending on, or you could write one guy plays a melody, other one plays a rhythmic figure. You know, there's a handful of options. As soon as you get, I would say, four horns, you now have the ability to cover complex chord and chord structures and harmonies, and five notes, which is what I have. I have five horns in this band. It gives you all the basic tools and skills to cover any type of harmonic situation you want in your palette. The thing is, when you want to pit one group against another, you don't have two or three different groups. It's kind of one group, and you have to split them apart and use them individually or in little mini groups or things like that. So that's where it gets tricky. It's one of these, it's a medium-sized group. And the way you write influences how the band sounds. You can write an octet to sound like a small group. You know, you don't use all the instruments all the time. Or you can write them to sound like a big band. Write them all together, you know. So
yeah.
So for me, that was a challenging situation, you know, to try to write for the size group. And there's not a lot of groups out there this size.
Yeah.
And I like that I can kind of straddle both worlds.
Yeah.
I can make it sound like, if I write it a certain way, it sounds like a small group.
Absolutely.
Real intimate. It's all about the soloist. And I write it another way, you can write it, and if you go, if you do it right, it can sound like a big band.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But anyway, that was how I arrived at the BP Express. The name, I kind of struggled with the name for a while. Everyone, one of my nicknames is BP, obviously.
Yeah.
But everyone used to call me BP, and I had written a tune, the title track of the CD I wrote. I actually wrote that a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And I had done a previous recording session, and it was such a difficult piece to put together that we had to bench it.
Wow.
So.
Yeah.
Was the BP Express is staying in the station, you know?
Absolutely.
But Anthony Watson said, our drummer. I have all this other stuff I've written that I haven't even recorded. Some of it the band hasn't even played yet. And that's why I'm so excited to get this going.
Yeah.
I'm branching in all different directions. The other thing is, I wanted to write in a way where it allows for the players to express themselves. And that this is one of the key things that I won't say a lot of writers, but I'll say quite a few writers might not think about. And it's not an easy thing to do. You know, we write music, and a lot of times what happens is the writing becomes the most important part to the writer. So they write, it's all about their writing, and they forget that it's an interaction, and the greatest music, and you know, I tend to cite Duke Ellington a lot because if you think about it this way, he wrote for players, but more importantly, the way he wrote his music was, it was written music, and it came out of his mind and his palette of ideas and sensibilities, but the music was written in a way where the individual players could express themselves on the part.
Yeah.
So you didn't need to wait for a solo for the tenor to get an idea of what the tenor player was about.
Yeah.
Now, you're not just a note in the chord all the time. And this is something that's hard to do because you have to write good lines for the players. You have to get players, and you have to sometimes encourage them to put personality into the written parts, which is, we're so taught to play together and everyone off on D4 and everyone this, and this is soft and this is loud and put a crescendo here, and these are all mechanical things.
Yeah.
So the thing is to write music in a way that allows the players to express themselves, and that's tough, and I'm not saying I always get it right, but this is something you think about. So sure. When you're writing, this is like a layer of thought that you write a line and you're like, well, I don't know, what do you think that's like for them? Maybe that'd be better to play on the trombone, or this person has specific skills, and maybe I could probably write this and they can do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the other thing is sometimes you write things. I write things, and for example, this piano player, Adam Birnbaum, mm-hmm. he's like the newest addition to the group, and he literally came in on this session, and he didn't sight read it, but it was a couple things that was pretty close. And he played, it's unbelievable. I'm so blown away by this guy, because he, and this is the great part of the whole exchange. Sometimes the players come up with ideas that are better what the writer thought.
Yeah.
Because you can't be an expert at everything. You know, like I don't know piano better than Adam Birnbaum knows piano.
Yeah, sure.
So sometimes they do things. So you push them in the right direction. I'm kind of looking for this. So, you know, when we get to this part, kind of do this. And then they try it. Like, man, I didn't even think of that. But I like that. Just do that or something like that. That's perfect. Those are negotiations that go on when you're on the dance.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's great. You know, because there's so many talent levels that are in a band, so it's good to tailor make those things. Let me ask you, speaking of talent, if you could go back in time, get into a jazz time machine, and meet one musician, who would it be, and what would you want to talk to them about?
Well, the quick answer would be a trumpet player, but you know, I think I would want to meet Duke Ellington, and for a number of reasons. I mean, I could say Louis Armstrong. That's. I think Duke, because he, the level, the depth of his thought, you know, and also the personality. Like you see his stage personality and what he was like in front of an audience. But then when I talk to the guys in the band about their interactions with him and how he used to interact with the band, that's just fascinating to me. Like how he would. He didn't always. he had a way of leading without leading. And just, I think it would have been interesting just to pick his brain. You know, he's obviously a fantastic player, and the writing is just, you know, arguably our greatest jazz composer in the 20th century.
Yeah.
Many people would argue that. I think it would be him.
Right on.
Just to see him in action. I'd be interested to see him in front of a band, see him talk to players, see what he's like when he's off the bandstand. How does he talk to an audience?
Yeah.
What audience members when he's off of the stage, like what exit on the whole thing.
Yeah, that would be great.
So that's an art form in itself.
Yeah.
Some people are better at that than others.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Who have you not played with yet that you would love to play with in the world of jazz?
Oh, man. Half of my idols. Kirby Hancock. I mean, any of these guys. Chick Corea.
Yeah.
Piano players right now. Keith Jarrett. I mean, any of the greats that are still around. Trumpet players, that are still around. Wynton Marsalis is unbelievable. I've worked with him some. I actually wish I had more contact with him.
Yeah.
At various times I've had some contact and played with him and talked to him and gotten advice from him about things. But I'm thinking more older players that are still around. That's tough. I mean, a lot of them are gone.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like you were saying earlier.
Obviously, all of the contemporaries. I'm a huge fan of a lot of the players out now. But for me, the thing would be to grab hold of the players that were around 40, 50 years ago. God, I think there's just any of the older players that are still around. Any of them.
Yeah.
It wouldn't even matter if the kind of music or what situation. I think half of the experience is just talking to them.
Yeah.
And the playing thing, when you're on the stand with them, you get that sensibility.
Let me ask you this. What's the nicest thing that a fan has ever said to you?
I mean, I remember doing a rehearsal with my big band, and Britt Woodman, the great trombone player with Ellington, I asked him to do my rehearsal, and he did it. And he was the guy that sat and played with Duke Ellington from 51 to 60 or somewhere in that area. And he's heard everything. He's heard the greatest. He's worked with everyone. And he said to me after, he goes, "Yeah, it's beautiful, beautiful. Yeah, I hear some Duke in there, but you got your own thing going too. That's beautiful. You got some of the essence of what he was about, but man, you got your own thing too. It's beautiful." And I was just like, "Wow!" And he doesn't need to say that stuff,
right?
You know? There's no point.
yeah, absolutely.
And Quincy said something nice to me too when we were in Paris. He said on the stage after I played a song, he goes, "Man, there's only a couple guys in the world that can do that." And it was referring to something specific with plunger playing. I just remember that. A couple of people came up to me afterwards and said, "Oh man, he really likes you, blah, blah, blah." And I was like, "Holy smokes." And I was talking to him about, you know, being in this band and being in that band. Yeah, little things like that. Fans, I would say that people, when they tell you that they really love what you're doing, and if they mention something specific instead of obviously any comment is wonderful to hear. I really love your music, but when someone says something like, "I really love blah blah blah, and it reminded me of this, and when you wrote this, it made me think of this," and there was a spot, you know, when they can dial in on something specific, like, wow, you actually got to, you know. Mission accomplished.
Yeah, yeah. Amen. What's the greatest thing about waking up every day?
Oh man. Well, as of late, it's all changed for me. But I just recently got married about a little less than 2 years ago, and that's been the greatest change of my life. Up until a couple of months ago, now I have a daughter. So I
cool.
have a daughter at the end of October. So honestly, for me, that's the greatest. But within the realm of music, I think, and just life as an artist, I wake up every day and I'm excited. I'm excited about the opportunities. I'm excited to get things out there. And I like the interaction. I like when you interact with other players and other people, that to me it's funny because we make jokes about this. People in the business will joke around about, like, yeah, I had to do this and this and this, and they're talking about all the gigs they're doing. They're, you know, whatever, whether they're playing somebody's wedding or a party or corporate event or whatever, and, you know, they got to pay their bills. And then they have that one gig that paid them $20, but they were playing all this, the friend of theirs wrote some original music and they're playing in some club. He's like, oh, the best thing of the whole month for me. It was the best. I did, oh, and they're kind of floating on a little creative high.
Yeah.
For a few days. You know, those experiences, that's what you kind of lay for those.
Yeah.
At least I do.
Yeah, no, that's great.
The key is to try to bring them a little closer together so you're not waiting too long in between.
Yeah, right. Constant succession of happiness. That's the way it should be.
Yeah.
If you had to explain yourself in the length of a tweet, how would you explain who you are?
Compassionate, lover of all things, music, life, and enrich other people's lives.
Right on. One final question I have for you. When you get to a point in your life where you're at Clark Terry's stage and age, and you have that chance to lean back in a chair and think about your impact on the world of music and jazz, what is going to be the most pleasing to you to think about on a career that you've spent making music and making people happy?
Yeah, the old, when you're at the end looking back, I want people to have been, I hate to use the word over again, enriched or on some level by interacting with me. And I don't even just apply this to the music world. On a personal level, did I bring something to your life that made your life better and made the world a little bit better place for you? And music is just an outlet for that. It's just an avenue. There's so many ways to do it. You know, you don't need to be on a bandstand to do that for people. But for me, it's a creative outlet, and I want to be able to look back and have touched people and to have people remember me as a creative soul. And you know, I think about the people that are so well loved, and everyone thought, oh, such a beautiful person. This person is such a, you know, say a beautiful cat, you know, or you know, and that's the greatest thing you can have, you know.
Yeah.
Liked by all, loved by all. You know, and in there is great musician, and oh, this guy was amazing, and whatever expletives they want to throw in there, but the ones that are universally loved, it's like a guy like Clark Terry. Because he gave so much, and he encouraged the youth, and he encouraged other musicians, and it was all coming from a place of love. I mean, that's where it's at.
Well said. Well said.
That's the gold standard.
Yeah, without a doubt. But Brian, hey man, thank you for your time. Good luck with this disc.
Man, I really appreciate it, Joe.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest jazz players in New York, KC, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Brian for his insight, rich stories, and candor. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino on the iTunes Store, or you can always visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.